Eintauchen. Der Podcast zu Ausstellungen im Lentos Kunstmuseum Linz.
Im Rahmen unseres Podcasts zur aktuellen Ausstellung Transformation und Wiederkehr – Radikale Nationalismen im Spiegel der zeitgenössischen Kunst tauchen wir mit der Kulturanthropologin Agnieszka Paschieka tiefer in die wissenschaftliche Auseinandersetzung mit aktuellen radikalen Strömungen ein. Das Gespräch führt Karin Schneider, Leiterin der Lentos Kunstvermittlung.
I want to introduce you first, Agnieszka Paschieka. Hello and welcome. Agnieszka is Research Fellow at the Department of Social and Cultural Anthropology at the University of Vienna and currently at the Yale University. So you are talking to us currently from New York, right?
I'm actually in New Hampshire at the moment due to the pandemic.
All right.
Does not necessarily need to be where one teaches and works, but in the US, yeah.
It's just nice to know that we have a long distance call, and we are really very happy that you are with us today, because you were really intensively searching on exactly those groups our exhibition talks about, the new right-wing groups and the radical nationalists. And as I understood from your work, you were really intensively researching them. And so I wanted to ask you if you maybe could just lead us a little bit to your research, what your findings were and what it was really about.
Yes, well, first of all, thank you very much for having me. I very much appreciate the opportunity to share my research findings. And yes, as you've already mentioned, I've been carrying an ethnographic project on far-right movements who are active in and between several European countries. I've been focusing on youth far-right movements in Italy, Poland, as well as on a Hungarian movement that is actually active in Slovakia. And I've been carrying this research with interruptions since more or less 2016, first thanks to a Marie Curie Fellowship at the University of Vienna, and now thanks to the Austrian Science Fund Fellowship. And as you, I guess, can imagine, it's been a very challenging project. On the other hand, I think any anthropologist would say that the projects they are doing are challenging, because any interactions with people is challenging, trying to find out something about their social lives, about the relationship they build, about their milieus. It's always challenging. And I was very worried before beginning to conduct this research, how it would go, whether I would actually manage to do any classical participant observation and interviews, whether I would get access. And now actually looking back, when thinking about my previous field experience, I do recognize that any fieldwork experience is challenging, and I'm trying not to exoticize this current project. This question of exoticizing far-right actors is something that I really take very seriously and see as a big problem, as an obstacle, and trying to engage with this issue and challenge this approach is something that has been very, very important to me. We can perhaps return to this issue later. But a bit more about my fieldwork. As I mentioned, I'm studying youth far-right movements. And the question that I've been asking throughout this research, and basically that is, I think, so interesting to many of us in Europe, in the US, and just globally, is like, what attracts young people to this movement? Why do they decide to join a far-right movement, become an activist, and to participate in demonstrations, in historical commemorations, but also in many, many other forms of activism? Why do they decide to spend their Saturday devoting collecting food for poor connationals in need? Why they decide to go to clean an animal shelter or donate blood? Because what was the biggest surprise of my fieldwork was the variety of activities that this far-right group engages, the activities that actually sometimes put into question the very term far-right. This is actually the term that the groups I'm studying do not like. They say, yes, for the lack of better terms, we know that people use it, but actually they do recognize the mixture of right-wing and left-wing ideologies. So it's this combination of very strong nationalist or identitarian orientation with inspiration from socialism and left-wing like tools of action, we could say they do borrow ideas and tools from numerous like left-wing movements. And this variety of activities, it's something that is surprising. And at the same time, I think it's really the key to understand this movement. But because it's precisely because of this diversity of activism that these groups have been so successful.
What would you say, thinking about your findings, I know that you can't put such a complex analysis in just one sentence, but what would you say also for yourself? What was the most surprising thing that you found out about these groups, also in respect of what you thought about them?
Well, probably the most surprising thing would also show that I did have certain projections and expectations inevitably, was how many students were there among this movement and how much in common I had with numerous activists, that we could easily move from the discussion about the far-right commemoration they were organizing and my attempt to understand why it was so important, why it was organized the way it was organized. We could move from that description to talking about the novel that we both happen to value and to discuss our favorite authors of favorite TV shows, which is not that surprising given that we, many of these people represent the very same generation that I represent. And we, no matter what they think about the damaging American culture or damaging capitalist influences, because this is one of the things they are changing in their discourses, we are influenced by the same global culture. We do, even if we read different newspapers, and even if certain news might be presented in different ways, we learn about similar things and similar phenomena. So that should not be that surprising. What was surprising often is like how much enjoyable this conversation was and how many commonalities I was really discovering when talking to these people. And of course, as I guess you can imagine, it was very often for me to reconcile them, to put together these different pieces, to recognize that the person with whom I had a fascinating conversation on a favorite artist or on traveling, then the very same person was promoting ideas that I find unacceptable or engaging in behaviors that were difficult for me to understand. So putting together these pieces was probably the hardest exercise. I should be probably more precise in saying it's not only that there were many students, people with degrees, not only masters, but often PhDs, but also generally the variety of these trajectories, variety of backgrounds in terms of class, education, financial status. The fact that since the offer is so broad, they're also able to attract and people from very, very different backgrounds in milieus. And despite this diversity, these movements are able to create a vision, but also a feeling of a very, very cohesive community, despite this diversity. And this feeling of community that I think attracts many of young people, this communitarian aspect, it's something that has been constantly emphasized.
Wow, when I'm listening to you, I suddenly picture these people much more in the midst of society or much closer to myself that I want this to be, or that I perceive it in my daily life. Do you think this, because these are really also very problematic ideologies you're dealing with, like racism, exclusion, anti-Semitism, radical nationalism. Do you think that these groups and the ideas they promote are really a danger for also for democracy? Or do you think in the end of the day, they are a margin phenomenon on the margins after all?
I think it is a difficult question. And I think answering this question demands from us, first of all, to critically analyzing this idealist take we have on democracy, because it's very easy to perceive this group as this outside threat that comes to our democratic societies and destroy it, and not to recognize that these democratic societies do have a problem, that many people do not feel recognized by this supposedly, presumably democratic systems they are part of, that there is the crisis of democracy with or without these groups that are purportedly constituting a threat. So yes, the groups I'm studying do challenge democratic orders. some of them just reject the very idea of liberal democracy. Other, if they were to come up with an alternative political system, would perhaps agree on some version of democracy. Yet others are just no interested in these political discussions because they emphasize that their aims are different. They are focusing on educating people differently, and they just not even interested in this specifically political discussion. But I think that for us, the problem is that we are not able to reverse the question, to start asking different questions. And we keep asking, why is the far right getting stronger, or in what ways are this movement threatening to us? The problem is we are not able to be more critical about this magic rest of the society and magic rest of the political system and ask, okay, instead of asking about far right, let's ask about the left. Let's ask about the liberal system. Why are they not getting stronger? Why the entire politics of in recent years has been dominated by this anti-narrative, where anti-far right, and this is what defines us, instead of challenging them through dialogue, through ideas, through action, rather than constantly denouncing them.
From my research myself, I know that in the beginning, there's always a kind of an urge, a question that leads you to the things you're doing. How was it with you? Why did you end up to do what you said before in the field of cultural anthropology, to do such a challenging research and encounter?
There were several. I can speak about several motivations, some of them like more scholarly, some of them just related to just me being a citizen in 21st century Europe and observing certain developments and just as a sort of like reaction to what's going on. But let's start with the scholarly ones. So in my previous research project, my doctoral dissertation that later resulted in a book published in 2015, I studied the situation on religious and ethnic minorities in Poland. And the exclusion, the means of exclusion, sometimes through very, very innocent means, and how supposedly positive ideas of multiculturalism and pluralism end up excluding the minorities. And of course, what was at stake was the very strong connection between the national and religious identities in the Polish context and this normalcy of Polish Catholic connection. So that made me very interested in the question on religion and nationalism and the connection between the two. But I was focusing, first of all, on the excluded, on the minority side. And at the other side, I wanted to look at the part that excludes. So that made me think about researching this far-right nationalist movement and try to understand their identities, what prompts them to think that this person does not belong here, or this person is different than us, or this is how we define our community. So it was like a wish to look at the phenomena that I was investigating earlier from a different side. And well, since we've been talking about the rise of the far right in Europe for a while now, and I think this discussion got so really like so heated in the context of the so-called refugee crisis in 2015. And what was really shocking to me were the reactions in Poland to the Law and Justice Party when they got into the government, and especially the approaching the government and the rule as an aberration, and the talking that everything that had to be done was to return to the previous liberal order and the civic platform rule before, to the normality. Returning to normality was basically the key discourse, the key narrative in the like mainstream liberal media. And this notion of normality, it's something that I was investigating earlier when studying this Polish Catholic connection, how the normality is being promoted and how this idea of is normal is used as a means of exclusion. And I wanted to investigate precisely this idea of normality, that the entire focus on countering far right is about returning to the normality rather than rethinking the normality. What is that went wrong? What is that pushes people to adopt certain extreme positions not to trust anymore democracy, to often like change political sides, even dramatically moving from the left to right. What is that made so many, many people disappointed and embrace this like right-wing populist promises, for instance? So yes, this wish to rethink normality, this liberal normality, was something that prompted me to do this project, I would say, in the second place, along with this scholarly interest. I'm not sure if this answer was...
No, I really like your approach a lot, because I really feel here that this is something that it's very familiar for me, this left academic attitude of those are the others, we don't want to deal with them, what our task is to exclude them from our podia, from our lecture halls, we won't give them a space and a voice, and that's basically what we do. And I understood your proposal to look also on what definitely also went wrong in the society that constructed an exclusion also for those people who propose exclusion but mm-hmm. are themselves excluded. Yeah, this is really, really interesting. I mean, just as the last question, because we always talked in our podcast series, of course, also of connections with the exhibition. Mm-hmm. And the exhibition poster where you see a Nazi painter referring picture from Wilhelm Dachauer, who was professor during the Nazi time, and Hitler commissioned a painting from him. And behind it lurks the emblem, the logo of the Identitarian movement, to say. And it looks a little bit as if it were a billboard where people just erased layers of history. So there is this in the post of the exhibition, which is also the artwork of Markus Proschek, who is also the curator of the exhibition, there is the proposal that there is a connection between the, let's say, alt-right or the Nazi movement, the old fascists, and these new movements and these groups. And now I have a final question that are actually two questions. One is, do you see this connection? And also, do these groups see a connection? Do they refer to history?
Yes, definitely. And I would say that history, history of fascism, of Nazism, of like generally of like this extreme nationalist ideologies is important precisely in these two ways that you indicated. So on the one hand, we should look for certain parallels. We should ask what historically have motivated people to embrace this kind of ideologies. And we should also, if we like everyone who engages in research on fascism, actually, who studied the demographics, who were the people who were really active in promoting those ideologies in 1920s and 30s, should not be surprising by my findings, because first of all, it was very, very diverse in terms of demographic. But secondly, the middle class constituency, this like educated bourgeoisie was very, very prominent. So in that sense, my findings are really far from surprising. It was definitely a question of the margins, even though, of course, we know very well that fascism meant something different in different contexts in Europe, and there was more peasant base, sometimes more of bourgeoisie, sometimes more of like elite or military constituency. But secondly, and that's more important for me, since I'm not an historian but a social anthropology, is what people do with history. So what do activists do with this historical knowledge, and how, by learning about history of fascism or history of Nazism, reading works of their beloved ideologues from the 1920s, 30s, and also later on of the post-war neo-fascist ideologues, what do they do with this knowledge? How they try to use it to shape the narratives on the past, and to what extent it inspires what they do today. And what was really interesting to me is that when you look at the calendar of their events, it seems that they are obsessed with history, because they go to the cemeteries to clean the tombs, or they meet the combatants of the World War II, and sometimes they support them in terms of like material goods. And numerous book promotions and conferences are definitely devoted to the historical topics. So you would think that they basically like live in the past. But what is interesting here is that they actually accuse other actors as the ones who are obsessed with the past, while they see themselves as promoting, first of all, the offer for the future. And when I ask, so why is all the obsession with the past? Oh, it's just learning, taking some examples, but it would be so anachronistic about talking about fascists nowadays. And they keep emphasizing, it's basically a mantra in all this move, among all this movement that I mentioned, is the sentence, fascist was a response to a particular set of historical, political, economic circumstances. Would be so stupid just to copy it. We need other solutions. We can just look for inspirations. And especially in Italy, it's so widespread among my participants to challenge this. They think of themselves as like futuristi, oriented toward the future, and they call the left-wing art as passatisti, so obsessed with like passato, the past. So it's this, they are the avant-garde, they are the revolution. They are the ones, even though they cherish so much the example from the past, but they think that it's really interesting how they accuse other actors who are looking too much towards the past rather than thinking about the solutions to the present day and offers for the future. And of course, we could say, oh, that's just their discourse. This is the way they want to think about themselves. But when you look at what they do at these very different activities that I shortly described, it does show actually that they do combine this different aspect. This narratives and activism oriented towards history is very clearly and smartly connected with these activities being done today. And with so it's not activism, a part of the activism connected with the past and part of the activism connected with what's going on and the needs of present-day Italians or present-day Poles and or contemporary Hungarians. No, I think this is why their narrative is so appealing to many young people, that they create like a very cohesive narrative around these very different kinds of forms of activism.
Thank you, Agnieszka. This was now really, really interesting for us. And it was really great to have you as an interview partner.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the invitation. And as I told you before, for me, this research and writing up is a learning process. And I also like learn through this kind of questions that you are asking. So thank you very much for giving me a chance to both think about my research and to share with wider audience my research findings. Thank you very much for this. I very much appreciate it.
Unsere finale Episode dieser Gesprächsreihe finden Sie ab 1. Juni auf allen gängigen Podcast-Anbietern sowie auf unserer Website lentos.at.